It's Friday, March 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Aung San Suu Kyi makes her selection for Myanmar's next president. A young Canadian prime minister visits Washington.
One of the lessons of Fukushima is you don't want to improvise an evacuation when the reactors are in meltdown.
Japan grapples with a slow build 5 years after a devastating meltdown. Also ahead, country music raises mental health awareness. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Four months after an overwhelming parliamentary electoral victory, Myanmar's National League for Democracy has nominated a close associate to Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi as its presidential candidate. Its lower house choice is Oxford University-educated Tin Chaol to replace President Thein Sein, who is scheduled to step down March 31st. Aung San Suu Kyi is disqualified from becoming president because the Constitution bars anyone with a foreign spouse or children from holding the post. Longtime Myanmar analyst Sean Turnell of Australia's Macquarie University told VOA's Victor Beatty that behind the NLD leader herself, Tin Chaol represents the best next choice.
Obviously, we would have loved to have seen Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi as president, but given that, you know, the political circumstances in Burma are such that she won't be, this is an excellent second-best choice. And in fact, I think U Thin Chaol is a man of such integrity, such courage, such quiet dignity, that he'd be a good first choice almost everywhere. So I think it's a very, very good pick indeed.
Well, how did he attain this identity, this character?
He's a man with his own great story. He's a long-time associate of Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi, a long-term friend. In fact, they were at school together going back quite some time ago now, and he then went on and was educated in Europe and Oxford. He's the son of one of Burma's great poets, and U Thin Chaol himself is actually something of a poet and a literary figure within Burma. So he has great stature, even, you know, outside of politics, but as a sort of cultural figure within the country. And he also shares something with many people in Burma, and that is, you know, he was arrested at various points by the old military regime. So he's got a great story himself. He's done some extraordinary things, and for all of those reasons, I think he's a very good choice for president.
Will he be a safe choice as far as the military is concerned?
Yes, I think he will be. U Thin Chaol is one of those people who's just liked by everyone. I don't think I have ever heard a bad word against him in any context. So I really don't see any real problems on that. He's a very quietly spoken person, extraordinarily calm. And I can't imagine that the military nor anyone else will object to his candidature.
Sean, the NLD also nominated a member of the Chin ethnic group who hails from Chin State in the country's northwest.
Very interesting choice, that one. Chin State is one of the poorest of all the states in Burma. So I think that underlines that the NLD is really going to take seriously the whole issue of economic development and a great effort to lift people out of poverty. He's also a Christian, which is, I think, also illustrates, again, another commitment of the NLDs towards diversity and towards religious pluralism. So I think that too, is a very meaningful and a very good choice.
Aung San Suu Kyi has indicated that even though she will not be president, she will rule by proxy through the next leader. Sean Turnell says that while this may seem a bit strange elsewhere, in Myanmar, such an unorthodox arrangement is welcome and is given her almost universal popularity. The military faction of the parliament has yet to name its nominee. A vote in parliament is expected later this month, and the candidates not selected as president are expected to serve as vice president. Well, up next, we have our social media reporter. That's the office that G. Abby Lee holds. She's right here in the studio with us to tell us the social media reaction to last night's debate in Florida. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Yeah, I had to go through contentious debates to get this position.
There you go. So who won this particular debate?
The answer on social media seems to be Bernie Sanders. The New York Times at NY Times on Twitter tweeted, "Who won the Democratic debate? Bernie Sanders gets the edge." And he shared a link to an article by the same title. So let's check out a couple of replies to that tweet. One person wrote, "Seriously, he says the same thing over and over. HRC, meaning Hillary Clinton, had intelligent answers. I used to like him, and it's all over now." Another person wrote, "Are you seriously asking who won? Bernie Sanders knocked Hillary Clinton out like Prince Nassim," referring to a former professional boxer.
Wow.
The NYT was not the only influential media outlet that came to that conclusion, actually. The Washington Post had an article titled, "Four Reasons Hillary Clinton Lost a Democratic Debate."
Well, I guess the debate victory is debatable. It's not too surprising, though, that Sanders was picked because he received a standing ovation for his closing remarks, right?
Yeah, that was quite impressive. What is surprising is that he shared a clip of the closing remarks on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, he doesn't usually do that. On the Twitter, the caption reads, "This is why I am running for President of the United States of America. Hashtag debate with Bernie." That's been retweeted some 10,000 times and liked by more than 15,000 people.
Well, that was quite a moment. How about Hillary Clinton's reaction?
She didn't share any clips of her closing remarks, but tweeted in defense of her paid speeches to Wall Street. She tweeted, "When someone says you're beholden to banks, but NY Times says your Wall Street plan is tougher."
Well, that's interesting. Usually it's the other way around, with Clinton sharing more on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Like I said, time and time again, you're probably sick of me saying this, but his Bernie Sanders' Twitter page is less prolific and less visual compared to Clinton's. But is that a necessarily bad thing? I am not so sure. What do you think?
It seems to be working for Bernie. It's just another style.
Yeah, I think so, too, because more information is good and Twitter savviness is also good. But his strategy on Twitter could be just in line with, you know, his brand, which is not always fancy or impeccable, but always consistent and likable. At the same time, I think the same goes for Secretary Clinton, because she always has that impeccable hairstyle, the pearl necklaces, and she has a very well-rehearsed delivery that you can't really beat on the debate ground. And that shows through, like, her multimedia strategy and also very hip and savvy tweets and all the Twitter tools that she uses. So, yeah, I think it's just difference in style. That's all for me today.
Well, thanks for your style. And this Twitter wrap-up, G, she's on Twitter at G Abby Lee. I'm out there at VOA Stevenson. And you can follow International Edition on our program account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama has welcomed fellow progressive leader Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to the White House for the first such state visit in nearly two decades. During an arrival ceremony earlier in the day, Mr. Obama highlighted shared values, noting universal health care, freedom of religion, and the diversity in both nations. In Canada's view, dynamic Prime Minister, many see a younger Obama. Like the U.S. president, the 44-year-old Trudeau campaigned on a similar message of hope and change. His Liberal Party swept Canada's parliamentary election last October by unseating Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his Conservative Party, who had been in power since 2006. VOA White House correspondent Arup Pandey was nearby and describes more about this visit to International Edition host Sarah Williams.
Well, first of all, it's getting a lot of attention because this is the first such state visit by a Canadian leader to the White House in 19 years, so you can imagine. And then this is the new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who's said to be a young version of Barack Obama. Trudeau won an election based on a campaign of hope and change with very similar parallels to how President Obama came to office here in the United States. So there's a lot of excitement surrounding that. But at the same time, like you said, there is a hefty agenda to talk about during the state visit. And some of the key issues that they're going to touch on during talks include climate change, boosting trade, and also the fight against the Islamic State militant group in Syria and Iraq.
And what about discussions about the migrant crisis?
Well, obviously that has garnered a good amount of attention, especially with the Canadian Prime Minister's approach to it. I mean, just months into taking office, he was seen at the airport in Canada, in Toronto, greeting Syrian refugees as they came off the plane. So he's been very out front, and I think Canada has met its goal of admitting 25,000 Syrian refugees into the United States, and some have contrasted that with the United States, with some of the politicians in the U.S., saying they're not okay with Syrian refugees coming in. So they've contrasted the policy between the U.S. and Canada in this regard. That, of course, is going to be an issue that's going to be talked about, the Syrian crisis in general. And U.S. officials, including President Obama, have praised Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau for the reception and for the assistance that Canada has offered to Syrian refugees and the humanitarian effort that they've contributed, and also the military contributions that they've made in the fight against the Islamic State.
Well, now, it won't be all work, because tonight there's going to be a state dinner. I'm sure there's quite a bit of interest in that.
There is, as there always is. They've already unveiled the menu with, some Canadian takes. You have Canadian whiskey and maple playing a role on the menu. And then, of course, you'll have the two first ladies, Michelle Obama and Gregoire Trudeau here. So there's always an anticipation of what, I hate to say, what the first ladies will be wearing and obviously the decor. This will be the 10th state dinner of President Obama's time here, and it'll be the first for a Canadian head of state since 1997.
Arup Pandey from the White House. With the fifth anniversary today of the massive earthquake and tsunami that triggered the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster, a Japanese court has ordered two restarted nuclear reactors operated by Kansai Electric Power at its Takahama plant west of Tokyo shut down. The action, brought by local residents who feared the risk it poses to local water supplies, is viewed as a temporary setback to efforts by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government to bring dozens of idled plants back online. Jeff Kingston, Asian Studies professor at Temple University in Tokyo, tells VOA's Victor Beatty in a Skype interview that the judge's injunction was a surprise and based on a lack of sufficient evacuation safety drills.
So essentially he's saying, we're not satisfied that the reactors are safe, even if they do meet the new safety criteria. And we don't think that the power companies have learned the lessons of Fukushima, because they still are not practicing evacuations. And one of the lessons of Fukushima is you don't want to improvise an evacuation when the reactors are in meltdown and you see plumes of radiation shooting into the atmosphere. So I think that the judge's ruling is widely supported by Japanese people who have deep anxieties about the Abe government's agenda of quickly restarting as many reactors as possible and boosting nuclear energy to about 20-22% of the national energy mix.
So what happens to the nuclear power industry in Japan now?
Well, they have well-paid lawyers whose job is to try to undo that damage. They will file an appeal. The two reactors in question, one of them is already idled because of what they call a glitch. So one of these reactors that was stamped as safe to operate actually already had a problem. So that was shut down. And the other one will be shut down by 8 p.m. today. The thing is that this may have broader implications, because around the country, there are similar lawsuits by citizens trying to stop the restart of reactors. And so this ruling, I think, may have stark implications for the nuclear village, which is what people in Japan call the various advocates of nuclear energy in the utilities and the government and politics and academics and the business community.
Well, Jeff, I imagine this is being welcomed by the anti-nuclear movement in Japan.
Yes, but it is an injunction, and it was issued at the district court. Last year, we had a similar situation, and the court overturned that injunction.
5 years on, nearly 100,000 people still have been unable to return to the Fukushima area, still more than half of who were forced to flee. But what's the situation here?
What once were vibrant communities have now become ghost towns. And the no-go zone, the evacuation zone, you know, basically these are abandoned towns left as they were, and people skedaddled. And many of them are living in temporary housing. And the interesting thing is the secondary deaths, that people were not killed directly by the meltdowns and the release of radiation, but more than 2,000 people have died as refugees.
Jeff Kingston says he has visited the Tohoku region of northeast Japan, where the Fukushima plant is located, and describes as uneven recovery efforts there. He says that while some isolated communities appear to be thriving, they are often surrounded by what he says are vast wastelands. Kingston says 5 years after Fukushima, most Tohoku residents, many of whom lost loved ones and were financially ruined, are deeply dismayed at how slow recovery efforts are taking. Meanwhile, in the region, North Korea has fired two short-range ballistic missiles into the sea, apparently in response to continuing military exercises by South Korea and the United States. The South Korean Defense Ministry says those missiles were fired early Thursday from North Hwanghae Province. They traveled about 500 kilometers, fell into the water off of the country's east coast. Such firings are not uncommon when animosity rises on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea hates the massive military drills by Seoul and Washington and calls them a preparation for invasion. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
On the heels of his two-time Grammy win and huge surge in popularity, country artist Chris Stapleton tackles mental health awareness in his brand new video for his song Fire Away, and it's created quite a buzz on social media. Nikki Strong of VOA Music and International Edition Sarah Williams fills us in.
Nikki, what made Stapleton choose to take on mental health?
Well, the actor in the video, Ben Foster, reportedly introduced Stapleton to ChangeDirection.org, an organization which aims to create a culture in which mental health optimization is valued and achievable. So he was down for the cause, so to speak, and he became a part of the organization's recent campaign to increase mental health awareness by enabling people to identify the five key signs of emotional suffering, which include change in personality, agitation, withdrawal, decline in personal care, and hopelessness.
How does the video go about addressing the issue?
Well, the video is shot like a short film. Chris plays a bartender, and then the actor Ben Foster, who plays a cop, comes to the bar and starts to drink. And then the film goes into a flashback as if we're entering his mind and seeing everything he's thinking. And in his flashback, you see the story of a young married couple, he and his wife. They look like they're living the perfect life. They just move into a new home. They start to fix it up, and then something starts to change in his wife's character. We start to see how those five keys start to manifest and how the husband who loves her dearly is dealing with it. So it's very touching, it's riveting, it's moving. If you've ever had a loved one struggle with depression or if you've ever dealt with depression yourself, you can really relate to this video. And because it is told through his eyes, you even get a glimpse of how her mental health impacts his. You feel the pain he feels as he endeavors to help the wife he loves, and you feel his determination to love her through thick and thin. And the actors Ben Foster and Margarita Levieva do a great job. So the video is well done. And at the end of it, the website changedirection.org flashes on the screen.
Well, mental health concerns are more common than we know.
Yeah, Change Direction's website says mental health concerns affect 1 in 5 Americans, like depression, anxiety, trauma, and that more people will die from suicide in 2016 than in auto accidents. And I think with this video, Chris Stapleton and changedirection.org is making the mental health awareness less taboo subject and less misunderstood. And ultimately, I think together they're trying to change how our culture overall deals with it. And the Fire Away video has been shared all over social media, so the word is getting out. Hopefully the change will go along with it.
You can see Chris Stapleton's video for Fire Away on his social media by going to Facebook.com and looking up VOA Music, or on Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also hear more of Chris Stapleton's music on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. Thank you, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Honey, load up your questions and pick up your sticks and your stones.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, anytime you like. You can also follow us on Facebook at VOA Asia and on Twitter at @VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day. Thanks for joining us. Come back when you can.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For months, the government of Russia has been conducting a trial of Nadia Savchenko, the Ukrainian pilot who was kidnapped by Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine in June 2014 and brought across the border to Russia against her will. Russian authorities claim she was complicit in the deaths of two Russian journalists, a charge Ms. Savchenko vehemently denies. In a statement issued March 8th, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden called the charges against Ms. Savchenko trumped up and her imprisonment unlawful. He noted that she has become a symbol of Ukrainian national pride and strength, who was even elected to the Rada from her prison cell. Nadia Savchenko's detention and trial demonstrate disregard of the rule of law. As Secretary of State John Kerry noted in a separate statement, in the 20 months since she was captured in eastern Ukraine and taken to Russia, Ms. Savchenko has reportedly endured interrogations, solitary confinement, and forced psychiatric evaluation. Both Secretary Kerry and Vice President Biden voiced deep concern over Ms. Savchenko's health and welfare. Since March 4th, they noted, she has refused food and water to protest her continued imprisonment by the Russian Federation. Both officials repeated U.S. calls on Russia to immediately release Ms. Savchenko and return her to Ukraine. As Vice President Biden said, Nadia deserves to go home to her family and friends and join her fellow RADA members to begin shaping a new Ukraine. Daniel Baer, U.S. ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, also condemned the detention by Russia of Nadia Savchenko, as well as the detentions of Oleg Sentsov, Alexander Kolchenko, Stanislav Klich, Mykola Karbyuk, Akhtem Chigos, and all other Ukrainians unjustly held in Russia, separatist-controlled areas in eastern Ukraine, and in Russia-occupied Crimea. He noted that human rights groups estimate that there are currently at least 20 such cases. The charges against Ukrainian citizens held for politically motivated reasons should be dismissed, said Ambassador Baer, and in the case of those being held within Russia, they should be allowed to return to Ukraine. By failing to do so, Russia continues to contravene its OSCE commitments, as well as its commitments under the Minsk agreements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.